So to start off, why don't you introduce the project as a whole?
Chimai, my name is Sven Hawkinson Jr., and I'm here today to talk about the project I've been working on with Mitch and Judy Simeonov in the village of Akyok, building a new Anyak. And what Anyak is a traditional open boat. And we used to have these up until the 1860s, and that's the last documented or last written documentation of these Anyaks being used on Kodiak. And then they switched over to the dories and then all the other modern day boats. And I actually first saw an Anyak in 1991 when I was in St. Petersburg, Russia, during the Soviet Union, when I was teaching English there as a second language. And I was looking at that, I was like, wow, that says Kodiak. That can't be. We don't have those boats because there's no living memory of those traditional open boats. Yes, we had kayaks, and everybody's known for the three-man, two-man, single-man kayaks. Yet these open-boat Anyaks are non-existent. And over the last 20 years, I've had the privilege to travel around and look at museum collections. And I've found, so far, 13 model Anyaks that exist around the world. Germany, France, Russia, Spain, where else? And in the U.S. So there's not many. I mean, imagine there was hundreds, but now there's only 13 models left. There's no full-size Anyaks that I know of that exist around the world and that I've yet seen. I mean, I'd love to see one because then it would really allow me to understand the boats itself. But this project took hold after I took a new job at the Burke Museum in Seattle and at the University of Washington. And so I had time there, and I had rediscovered with another colleague, Nadia Chikinsky, they had an Anyak. And so that was one of the 13. And so I spent a few hours every week just looking at the boat, photographing and drawing it out, sketching it out. And talking with Mitch and Judy and Spiridon and Tekin, they're like, well, let's just make it. Let's make model Anyaks. And so in 2014, working at the camp, we made 13 models. And following Alfred Nomov's rule when he taught us how to make traditional kayaks, no glue, no nails. And that's really important. That way we follow and we learn the right way to build it instead of having to relearn what we've done. And after that, Mitch and I and Spiridon were like, well, let's just make a big one. And we're like, well, we don't know what we're doing, but we have enough knowledge. And also at the Burke Museum, they have both an Umiak and an Anyak, and there's differences. As I've been doing more and more research into our traditional open boats, Anyaks, I come to find out that actually Anyaks, within the Yupik region, that term goes all the way up to just south of Nome. They use the term Anyak over into the Chukotka Peninsula with the Siberian Yupiks. And I started chuckling because I was looking at this book, and it's in Russian, and in there, the title is written Umiak and Bedara. But then inside, you look, and I'm reading in Russian, I just start chuckling because they're like, well, these are the terms we've used, but the natives here call them Anyaks. I'm just like, well, why don't you just call it an Anyak instead of an Umiak? Because it's a very different boat. And so I've learned that Anyak goes from south of Nome all the way down and up into the Prince William Sound. So that's kind of exciting to figure out, hey, wait a minute, as scholars, we've been mislabeling this boat. And so that's something that we need to change, is one. But then the other cool thing is, as I've done the research on these Anyaks, the bow, this really bulbous bow on these boats, and you find them in the archaeological record from Karluk, K1, and you find them in the models, and I'm like, well, what does that bow mean? Oh, it's cultural. Yeah, it's Aleutic. Actually, no, it's not just that. It has a function. And I was talking with Erin Harrington and her boyfriend Ryan Johnson at the time, and they're like, Ryan was like, I just added one of those to my boat, and that actually decreases the energy, basically decreases fuel consumption, increases the speed. And I'm looking at it, I was like, we've had that on our boats for 1,000 years or more on these Anyaks. And And I'm sitting there going, wow, that bow has a real huge function for moving, especially in the waters here in Kodiak. So that was really fun to discover. And then over the last, since 2014, 2015 comes along. And so last summer, working at the Burke Museum, I made a frame just to understand how I can actually do it. Came here to Kodiak, came home, went out to Akiak, worked with Mitch and everybody at camp, and we made a frame in a week. We got the bow and the stern from the driftwood on the beach, off the beach, and then we bought all the wood from here, spruce, and then we tied it all. We had the frame, and then this year, and I did the same thing at the Burke Museum where I built a 27-foot Anyak there for the museum, and we made the paddles and we did everything. We sewed the skins. And that time when we sewed the skins, it was one of these things where how do you sew the skins together? I didn't know. And so I had to learn as I went. That's where it would have been fun to have both Susie Malute and Coral Chernoff to be able to help because they're such amazing skin sewers and skin workers. They just do amazing work. So I figured that out and made that boat, and then we sailed that one this spring to see how it went, and it was pretty amazing because it doesn't take much to move those boats. They're light, but the one thing is they're really tippy. So getting the right ballast, it's a process as I'm learning, and as we do more, I think the bow needs to be a lot heavier than lighter. So that was one of those eureka moments. We got in the water, and it's like, okay, I got to do this, got to do that. I come back here, and you know, working with the community, we finished tying, and then we finished putting the skin cover on that, on the Anyak, and then I finally figure out that the way I was sewing the skin, I basically had to turn the skin upside down, which makes sense, and then sew it that way. So the one at the Burke Museum, I need to fix. But the one we did in Akiak, when I was sewing that, I was able to figure out to make sure that was falling right. Because when you look at the kayak that you have here from the Harvard University, the Peabody Museum, you look at the skin, you can't really tell the way it was sewn. And the reason it was sewn inside out and sewn together. And then when you put the skin on and the actual inside, you don't see that bulk, that bulge on the skin. So it's really cool to see that. So I figured that out, and then while we're finishing up the boat, we painted it with buoy paint to give it strength. We used a fabric that was donated by George Dyson, and then what else did we do? Everybody in the camp helped make 11 paddles. And so it was basically a whole camp-wide effort to help us finish the boat in that week. So it took us literally 2 weeks to finish an Anyak from start to finish, working on it as a community. And so we sailed the boat. We tested it in Akiak in August on a Friday. And, you know, we originally first went out and we tipped it. Because we didn't have the balance down right. But once we figured that out, and the wonderful thing behind that experience was there was kids there watching, what are we going to do? Are we going to give up? And we all got out. We're sort of laughing because we felt and knew probably what was going to happen. And so we're just laughing. We got out. We tipped the boat, emptied it out. And immediately Mitch and Albert and Roy got back in it, and they paddled around. And it worked perfect. With the right balance. And because the boat in Akiak is only 16 feet long, so it takes less people. But I think that over the next few years, and I'm hoping that others will finish their boats and also make new boats, but they need to make the bow heavier. They need to make the actual frame a little bit heavier than the frames we have now. And I'm thinking that when you look at how that boat cuts through the water, that wave coming off the boat, as it comes around the bow, it goes underneath. It's more of a flat-bottom boat, but that wave actually helps push the boat up. And so the energy you're putting into it is being put back into the momentum, so it's doubling it. And it's kind of fun to watch that. And I have a lot more questions now than I did before, because I'm like, okay, how's that work? Okay, how do we seat the paddles? How high do we have the people sitting? How much weight do we put in the boat? And so all these questions we can't ask our ancestors of how they did that, because we don't have that. But yet, at the same time, thanks to the models, we can take that model. We've built a full-size one now. We've actually sailed two of them. Now we can actually start doing the full testing on it to see how much weight we need to put in the bow, how much weight needs to be put in the center and the stern, how high the seats need to be, what kind of ties to make it so that it maintains its structural, the strength of it, but also the flexibility, which is one of the things they designed into that boat. To, all right, when do we want to use traditional skins? And how traditional do we want to go with it? And so these are things that I hope will be happening in the community, especially after our being able to make this happen. It's been a wonderful learning curve, but also it's been wonderful to go and show what we could do with a model, to put a full-size one that's 16 feet, 27 feet long, out there, so that others can see that, but also we can say, hey, wait a minute, what about all these other objects that we have out there? Why don't we have them here? And why isn't it just that that's what we do? We make those things as part of who we are from this region, but also to show how important museum collections are, whether it's at the Aleutic Museum or the Baranof Museum or the Maritime Museum. That information that's there is really, really important for not just us now, but for our future. Because imagine being told your whole life, oh, you're dumb, it's dumb native stuff. And yet you go and you research and you see this technology that's been there that preceded all these advancements in computers and electronics and all of that. We had that. And I look at that going, that's pretty ingenious. What else are we missing that we're not asking the right questions about, that we can then say, hey, wait, Kodiak, you guys have a lot to celebrate. And the boat is one example of, I think, many that we can continue to learn from. And so to me, I feel like we've been scratching the surface and we're just starting to get down to a place where we can start seeing more and more.
Before the interview, you were talking a little bit about repatriation of knowledge. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit more about what that means?
Well, for me, I use repatriation of knowledge because there's a lot of things in museum collections that don't fall under a law that was passed in 1991. It's a law that deals with repatriation. And in that law, they said that all human remains, associated funerary objects, and cultural materials used in a cultural practice, religious practice, should be returned to their tribes. I mean, that's a simplified version of that. And those things are very important. The human remains should be returned. The funerary objects should be returned. They should be reinterred. Give us the respect through returning those objects. And that's been happening since 1991. In fact, Larson Bay, the Kodiak Area Native Association, Gordon Puller, who led that, Dr. Rick Knicht, who was involved in that, they are one of the first ones to actually push that law. And so Kodiak is pretty important to that repatriation law that was passed by Congress in 1991. But part of the things that aren't part of the repatriation are the clothing, are the tools, are these Anyaks. There's so much more information than just the objects of human remains and sociofunerary objects and religious objects. There's more objects there that don't fall under that law. And my philosophy is, how can we work with the museums so that we can get that knowledge back? Work with them to repatriate the knowledge so that it becomes part of our living knowledge, not, oh, that's a museum thing, that's over there. No, it's here, and our children understand it, and they know how to make boats, they know how to make paddles, they know how to make kayaks. All of that stuff is important. And the only way we can do that is by building relationships and trusting relationships with the museums that are not in the United States, that are outside, and they really don't have to follow any of these laws. But if we build relationships of trust and build it so that we can share this knowledge, we can get the knowledge, and then we can share what we've learned about it. But also, it becomes, I think, a win-win for both, because we not only gain that knowledge back by having them repatriate it. I mean, some people don't like that term, but I'm like, well, then, okay, just give it back. Or they're going to say no. Well, let's work on building relationships so we can have that knowledge going back and forth, but the knowledge comes and goes into our children.
One of the concepts that really interests me is getting kids involved in a hands-on way, because from my own childhood, what I remember from traditions my own family celebrated were the ones that I got to do hands-on, mm-hmm. and that I learned about by doing them on certain days or just doing them as a family. Mm-hmm. So can you talk a little bit about how, with this recent project, you managed to reach out to some of the kids, and you talked about a camp. Could mm-hmm. you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, working with Mitch and Judy with Aukyuk Kids Camp, and I've had the privilege to have worked with them for well over 16 years now. And every year we bring something new. And I did this with the Aleutic Weeks when I worked at the Aleutic Museum. We would bring something new to the camp so that we can teach our children and ourselves also more about what we had. This year it happened to be finishing up doing waterproof stitch and making paddles. And they did skin sewing as well, but it's that hands-on, actual face-to-face learning. To me, that is so important for our students, our children, to learn. Of you can't just learn something from a computer or reading a book. You should be able to use your hands and use what you learn. And you make mistakes. To me, one of the biggest learning moments that we had was when we finished the boat, we paddles ready, we rolled it over, we got back up, we dumped the water out, we got back in. And all the kids that were there that were watching, to me, that was a learning moment of, even if it looks like you can fail, you learn from that mistake and you move forward. You don't do that again. And so to me, those are really, really important lessons, because without trying or taking a risk, I would never have done it. And so, yes, we were successful in making the boat, but I think the success will come if others actually make their own. And by the way, you can't make a boat by yourself. It's a community. It takes an entire community to make something like that happen. But that hands-on learning, and then when I'm sitting there talking with the young men and women there, and I look at them, I'm like, look, if you look at this boat, that's an amazing design of engineering, and engineering put into it, of the bow to the ties to the skin. That's a lot of ingenuity. That's amazing to me. And that I just learned from starting of researching models.
So to back up all the way to the very beginning, as far as the Aukyuk's purpose goes and what sets it apart from other types of vessels, what would that have been historically?
The Aukyuk's actually were used to move entire villages. When the Russians first came in 1784, with Shelikov and then Baranov, they immediately took those boats. They took those boats because every village had enough of those boats to pick their village up and move. And so the Russians didn't want them to have those boats. So they took those Aukyuk's and they used them for the Russian-American company. And in fact, one of the documentations, I'm just sitting there reading this going, did you just write that? But they wrote that in the 1800s. We took the women and children hostage, but we paid them for their open Aukyuk's. And I'm like, took our women and children hostage and you paid us for the boats? I don't think you did that either. I think you took them and said, either you guys do this or they die. They wrote that probably just to make themselves sound better, justify, you know, enslaving an entire nation.
Mm-hmm. And how would it have been different from a boat that's more commonly known about, like the kayak?
Well, the kayaks actually survived because the Russians needed our men to go out to hunt. The Russians were here for the sea otters. That was their goal. They weren't here for the land. They weren't here for conquering. They were here for the gold, and that was the sea otters, and that's why they nearly went extinct. Well, I shouldn't say they nearly went extinct. They were depleted really down by the time Alaska was sold, but they nearly went extinct after the Americans came because they gave them rifles. Before, they were hunting with spears and bows and arrows. So the sea otters actually had a chance. With a rifle, no. The population dropped. But the Russians needed us, needed the natives to have their kayaks so they can go out and hunt the sea otters and hunt for food. So if you look at early historical accounts, the three-man kayak was invented or created during the Russian period. We had single-man and double-man kayaks before, but the three-man kayak was built. And then that took over, and so they took all the Onyaks, the open boats, away from both the Onondaga people and the Aleutians and the Aleutic people, Suqbia people, here in Kodiak and Prince William Sound. And what's interesting is in 1778, when Captain Cook sailed through, Weber did some beautiful drawings of the Onyaks up in the Prince William Sound. In the same breath, they get down to Unalaska. In the same time period, they get down to Unalaska, there's no more open boats. The Russians destroyed those because then they can control the people's movement.
So considering that you're just now, considering the years and years of not having had this knowledge at your fingertips, what's the next step trying to kind of perfect the design?
The next step is to get back into Onyak and test it out. I need to think about making sure that we're doing the skin sewing right, but also getting the weight of the boat right. That bow, I think that bulbous bow with the weight of the wood, needs to be a lot heavier than what I made it, what we made it, not I. The bow needs to be heavier than what we originally made it because it needs to be able to, one, take the brunt of a wave, split the wave easily, but also add ballast to the boat itself because the skin frames are really light. For that Onyak and Akyak, it takes 3 of us to lift it, 5 to just pack it away. So it's not very heavy. And so I think that's the next thing, is the testing of the boat, how much ballast we need in it. And the other one is you don't realize that you need to test how long of paddles do you need.
Mm.
And so do you make them the size of yourself? Do you make them taller, longer, thinner? These are things that I think over the next few years, all of us, I'm hoping, will be experimenting with.
Would people have been using one long paddle?
No, they don't use the double-bladed paddle. In fact, the Peabody Museum is the only museum that has, so far, a full-size double-bladed paddle that is similar to the ones we find in museum collections from Kodiak. So when we found that one in 2011, I think it was, we made, I sketched it out, and I think immediately it was Gary Kanagan that came. I brought the form back. Gary Kanagan made one, and who else made one? There's a couple other people who made those within a month after we got back of learning that. And Gary actually took his out and tested it. It was a lot of fun to see on his video what he did. But they use single-man paddles, single-person paddles, single blades.
Mm-hmm. And so you're going to go back to Seattle, mm-hmm, and kind of work that out, and then what's the next step?
Well, next year we plan on just making a kayak frame, and I'm hoping that we'll be able to work with Alpha Nomov, depending on his time, but we want to make a kayak frame for next year, so we just build on the flotilla of boats, traditional boats, and we've already done double-bladed paddles in Akyak. That was 3 years ago, but next year we'll do the kayak. And then keep experimenting with the Onyak itself, making the paddles a little bit longer, the handles longer, not the blade, and testing it with ballast. And what I would like to do is just get jerry jugs of water and put that in the boat to see at what is the optimal point of too much weight versus too little weight, and getting the balance right too, so that when you sit in there, you don't feel like you're going to roll over like we did the first time. So again, that's those things that we don't know. We can't go back to our ancestors to ask. And there's nothing written about it. And so it's one of these things that it's like, okay, how can we learn more? And the only way we're going to learn more is getting in there and just expect to roll over and be wet, but also at the same time learn from those mistakes and move and be able to row forward, I guess.
And what about the skin that would have been used? Would they have used seal?
They used sea lion.
Sea lion.
And that I have written records of them using sea lion skin for the Anyak itself. They used harbor seals for the kayaks, but sea lion skins for the Anyaks.
Would they have been covered with fur?
No. Fur would have been off. What they do is they, and this is something that I think Coral's probably figured it out. She's pretty amazing. You take the skin, you wrap it up, and you let it soak for a little while in a slow-running stream. You let it ferment. And then when you take it off, you can actually just scrape the fur right off.
Hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Would they have used female sea lions?
I think probably female would be better because the males were probably have holes in them.
Oh, from all the fighting.
Yeah.
Hmm. Right. And is that going to be part of the process? You were talking a little bit about how traditional do you want to go?
Mm-hmm. It takes about 9 sea lion skins for an Anyak, and that's if anybody's ever had that, anybody who's actually gone out to harvest a sea lion to get that and then process it, it's a lot of work. But to do that without any compensation is almost not feasible. But at the same time, it's like, I want to figure out how we can make it happen. So, well, in time, I think something like that will come about.
And so we have a couple of minutes left. How are you funding these projects?
Well, this year, thanks to the Siri Foundation, they sponsored a majority of the camp. Mitch and Judy get funding from Kodiak Area Native Association, CANA, and then Koniag and Akiakuya Corporation, and then private donations. And so it's mainly the camp we've managed to run literally on not a shoestring budget, but pretty much that, where we get a lot of donations. And the bulk of our expense is flying people from Kodiak out to Akiak. And then after that, it's then the food. But, you know, this year we feel very lucky to have had the Siri Foundation provide the funding. And that was through, their granting. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.